with it all the way from the state of. I made it with my team.
The Senate Education Committee will come to order. We have a full agenda today, and looking forward to hearing testimony and reporting. And we were beginning with some of our vocational student, or career and tech, I should say, student organizations. And at my request, we are having FFA and FCCLA, some of the student leaders that are will speak for what their organization is about and what it means to them that to participate. So if you'll come forward, I think we have Morgan Croft and Skylar Borchert from FCCLA. Is that correct? And Jason Trendle and Liz Rattle. If you come to the table, we can pull up some extra chairs and just share those mics. Whoever's going to begin, just say your name and where you're from and affiliation with for the record.
Hi, my name is Morgan Croft. I am a senior at Spring Lake Park High School, and I am the FCCLA National Vice President of Public Relations.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and, are you going to be first to speak?
Oh, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I am one of the 10 national officers elected in a rigorous process of national officer elections. I was well prepared for this challenge by being a Minnesota FCCLA state officer last year, by being a regional FCCLA officer, having experienced local chapter responsibilities, and with the help of my advisor, Ms. Lori Henry, a family and consumer sciences teacher. My involvement in FCCLA has been life-changing for me. When I was in ninth grade, I made the decision that changed my life. I walked into my first FCCLA chapter meeting. I was shy and terrified, but I made the absolute right choice by staying at that FCCLA meeting. You see, my family had moved approximately 30 times before I reached ninth grade. I was used to not becoming attached to a single school. This meant that I didn't get very involved at school because I left before I had the opportunity. Once I was enrolled in my current school in ninth grade, we set a goal that I would stay at the same high school I started in. Since then, I have moved 3 more times. My family has struggled with the economy and being laid off from work, but I have managed to stay at the same school, giving me the opportunity to make FCCLA a very important part of my life. The day I went to my first FCCLA meeting, I was elected to be chapter reporter historian. I had no idea what I was getting myself into or if I had the ability to fulfill the duties of this position. Apparently, my advisor and chapter members knew I could do it. Just the act of staying and being elected, I was on my way to becoming a new person. I walked through that family and consumer sciences classroom door, a shy, quiet, and secluded ninth grader, and today I am completely changed. That meeting opened my eyes to so many opportunities. I have truly developed into a leader, and it started with that first meeting. I have the ability to positively affect my school and community. I can speak in front of a crowd. I can talk to people I don't know. I didn't have the skills I have now, such as organization, time management, teamwork. Now, I have over 400 hours of leadership training as a regional, state, and national officer, and I have learned about different learning styles and different ways that leaders work within a team. I now appreciate the skills and tendencies I have, know what skills I can work on to improve, and also have more understanding of styles of other FCCLA leaders and advisors I have worked with. These are life-altering leadership lessons that will positively affect me, my family, and my ability to function in a workplace setting. Because of this, I can be a member of a team of officers and contribute thoughtful reflections, an attitude of diligence, and be a role model for younger members. I see with empathetic eyes those members who may be unsure of themselves or shy to speak up and can offer encouragement. I appreciate FCCLA advisors who are supportive and encouraging. I appreciate the leadership challenge I have had to stretch my abilities and experiences. I have courage to take on new tasks. Because of my experiences, I know that I can make a great deal of difference by solving community problems. I know I can make a difference. In the 5 practices of exemplary leadership, I have already learned many ways to model the way and encourage the heart. FCCLA is a wonderful organization that has provided its members with countless opportunities. FCCLA has many programs to guide members to achieve their goals and help individuals, families, schools, and communities. Recently, a story on Career Builder was carried on CNN. It listed 10 careers that are significant for adaptability for future jobs. Family and Consumer Sciences was listed first. My interest in FCCLA and Family and Consumer Sciences classes, my experiences in writing and editing for newspapers for FCCLA will help me consider my future career interests. My officer roles have allowed me to pursue an interest in writing and journalism. Now, as Vice President of Public Relations, I write articles for the national magazine called Teen Times. As Vice President of Public Relations as a state officer last year, I worked on the newspaper for our state called The Horizon. This year, all the Minnesota FCCLA state officers have an alumni state officer as a career mentor. I have an FCCLA alumni mentor, Pam Muldoon, who has a radio network and a business radio show. Being involved with the applied academics of FCCLA has taught me to organize my time, learn about styles of working with people, developed my research, writing, and reading skills, taught me to think about systems of people and associations, introduced me to career role models, and allowed me to experience many opportunities in spite of challenging family economic times. The applied academic experiences of FCCLA have proven to be motivational, supportive, and challenging to me. I am grateful for my school district for supporting FCCLA. I am grateful for the State Association of FCCLA for quality youth development programs and events. And I am grateful for the Minnesota Legislature for supporting FCCLA as a career and technical student organization.
Thank you. Skyler?
Senator Olson, members of the committee, my name is Skyler Borkhart. I am currently a sophomore at Litchfield High School and serving as State President-elect of Minnesota FCCLA. As a sixth grader, I became interested in an organization called FCCLA. My advisor thought this would be a good experience for me. My experiences in middle school allowed me and encouraged me to run for region office. With my role as both a region officer and now a state officer for Minnesota FCCLA, I am learning valuable lessons about myself and working with others, learning to work with adults and youth, and developing projects that positively affect my school and community. This year, my officer role is to schedule and organize the state level of competition. This means I will be contacting over 200 judges for our state competition categories and scheduling about 1,000 youth into competitive event schedules. I've learned to budget my time and am able to speak on the star event categories and conduct training sessions so all members can carry out their events effectively. My local chapter has been very active in the competitions offered with FCCLA's programs. There are 45 different competitions that require students to research and develop projects, write, organize, and present what they have learned to a set of evaluators with a scoring rubric. The ability to apply our motivation and interests in this way helps us to show off our various academic skills, such as reading, writing, speaking, and researching, in a real-life way. My chapter has been active in the FCCLA competitive events, some of which include entrepreneurship, teach and train, focus on children, interpersonal communications, life event planning, and various other service projects. Last year, our chapter even won a national award from FCCLA for one of our project areas. These star event opportunities are done as a team or as an individual and usually take about 6 months to complete and are rigorous and very challenging. I have been involved in 4 star event categories. One of my projects was a Stop the Violence project, which focused on the inclusion of all in my school. Another project emphasized the importance of safe teen driving habits, along with the national program called Families Acting for Community Traffic Safety. When I was in ninth grade, I incorporated the national program Career Connections into my career investigation star event. I was able to determine that my skills and abilities were evident in the field of law. Being a lawyer would require me to research and to speak with clients in a courtroom situation, and also to use my writing and interpersonal communication skills that I have gained through FCCLA. With FCCLA being the student organization that focuses on the family, I knew having a focus that would focus on the family would also help me in the various aspects of law. As a state officer, I also have an alumni mentor who is a lawyer. Sean Sween, the former state president of Minnesota FCCLA and national president of FCCLA, attended Harvard Law School and now practices law in her hometown. The FCCLA alumni mentor experience with a person who is in a career that I am considering has been a valuable part of my state officer year. The Search Institute, based in Minnesota, has done youth development research that shows youth start losing their positive assets beginning in grade 8. This is especially true for boys. Assets are those activities and support systems that help youth to avoid troublesome outcomes. It has been important to me to begin and to stay involved with FCCLA and its programs and projects since sixth grade. It has helped me to figure out my career interests and goals. This year, my state FCCLA director encouraged me to apply for the National Youth Advisory Council for Youth Service America. I was chosen for this council and have been involved with a group of young people from throughout the country. We help to fund projects from various nonprofit organizations with grant funds that we receive. We also recently attended the Voices in Action National Youth Summit and saw valuable and influential speakers such as Secretary of Education Arne Duncan and White House Youth Engagement Director Kelpen Modi. I also serve with adults on the state FCCLA Board of Directors. It is important to learn the skills of working side by side with adults in these governance roles. The difference FCCLA is making in my life is important to me and others like me. We are contributing to our communities, adding positive energy to our schools through our projects, and applying our academic skills to our career and technical programs. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My FCCLA experiences have been life-changing. Once again, thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Liz Rabby. I'm here representing the Minnesota FFA Association. This year I have the honor of serving as the Minnesota State FFA Vice President. What that entails is serving over 9,000 FFA members across the state of Minnesota, helping them develop their potential for premier leadership, personal growth, and career success through agricultural education. And what we would like to speak with you today about mostly is how important agricultural education is to students like us and how it's affected who we are as people today. I walked into an agricultural education classroom in seventh grade, and I was told that I was going to use a table saw, and that thought scared me quite a bit. But, you know, with the little helpful hand of my ag teacher, I thought it was a pretty cool thing and kept going. By the time I was in ninth grade, I walked into the ag classroom of our high school and just didn't really know what that place was going to mean to me by the time I walked out 4 years later. I got dragged to my first FFA meeting by my advisor because she saw some potential in me and wanted to see where I could go. I can honestly say that the reason I've chosen the career path that I have is because of that agricultural education instructor and the program that I had at Martin County West in Sherburn. I guess my background in agriculture is one of a pretty typical agriculture student, or typical as we used to say. I grew up in the little town of Trimont, really? Surrounded by corn and soybeans, which is as far as the eye can see. I'm a typical ag kid, and I grew up riding in the combine with my grandpa on, in fall afternoons, and that's the way I like to spend my time. But as a freshman in high school, I had a lot of energy, and I didn't quite know where to channel it, and my parents didn't quite know where I was going to channel it either. So as soon as Ms. Woolleader got her hands on me in the ag classroom and started directing me down the leadership path of FFA, I got a little more focused, and I found out that what we learn in agricultural education, this hands-on learning that we always talk about with career and technical education, is really what hooks kids, and it's what makes us excited to learn. And coming from that small ag background, you see a lot of kids leaving rural America, and I can honestly say someday I want to go back. I want to have an impact on my community, and I would like to teach high school agriculture or take part in an agribusiness that my family owns someday. Whatever that may be, I can say honestly that the FFA has impacted that. Agricultural education has impacted that. And I'm very lucky to have ended up where I am.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Jason Trundle, and I'm also representing the FFA Association. This year, I have the honor to serve as the Minnesota FFA State President, along with Liz and four other teammates. I get to do all those great things that Liz talked about, represent those 9,000 people, travel around the state and put on different camps and conferences for these kids who are really desiring and trying to figure out where they want to go with their life. My father was an agricultural education instructor, and ever since I think I was about in fourth grade, he looked at me and said, "Jason, when you get to ninth grade, you're going to take an ag course, whether you like it or not." Well, it just happened that my ag teacher called me up the summer of my eighth grade and said, "Jason, we're going on a Boundary Waters fish and canoe trip. Would you like to join?" And I thought for a second, I was like, what is this going to include? Because I love to fish and I love to camp. There's got to be some trick to it, right? And he said, "Well, we're going to ask you to put in an additional 30 hours, classroom hours. We're going to do things looking at survival, map, GPS. We're going to go out. We're going to learn how to canoe, some different things like that." And I said, "All right, I'm in. If I can go fishing and hang out with a bunch of people that love something that I do, I'm all in." And so from there, I took some different agriculture business classes throughout my year in high school, some leadership courses. And what I really like is I'm a very hands-on learner. I can't go in, I'm not going to use my calculus that I learned in 11th grade to go outside and measure the light waves of the sun. What I am going to do is when I own my own house, be able to fix that broken doorknob, be able to understand and figure out why my garage door opener is not pulling the door up how it should. It's those hands-on practical skills that I gained that will be most beneficial to me. And the unique part that I really took advantage of within agricultural education is we are actually asked as part of class to have a work experience, to have a supervised agricultural experience. And for me, it was an area where I could channel my broad vast of interests and figure out maybe what I wanted to do. I started my own lawn mowing business. I volunteered at a local fish hatchery. I raised some hogs. I worked on a local farm. I volunteered within my community. And all these things came back, whether it was, you know, record keeping to doing reports in class, and was a tool that I was able to use to really figure out who I am and kind of where I potentially want to go. So as I look at it, the agricultural education portion for me has been a tool that's really helped to direct me in my future. And the FFA has just been an added bonus because I've been able to give back to the kids and to myself, continue to develop and figure out where do their passions lie? Where are their talents going to be used? Are they going to be in seats like yours? Are they going to be in seats like mine? We don't know for sure, but we're there to provide them with the support and the energy and the direction, as Liz said, that we can possibly provide. So thank you very much for hearing us. I think at this time, Madam Chair, we'd open it up for any questions.
Yes, thank you very much for your testimony. And I will confess that I picked the two vocational or career tech student organizations that have had the longest track record and are also the largest in the state. There are additional ones. Many of you have heard of DECA and Skills USA, which used to be VICA, Vocational Industrial Clubs of America, and there are others that relate to other occupational fields. But these two have had the longest track record and I think are very able spokespeople for the effect and the value of having student organizations as a part of their career and technical programs within their high school. And I'm admitting a bias to all of you, but I just wanted you to hear this. And I would welcome you to have it. Doesn't it give you hope for the future when you hear young people like this? We've got to be doing something right. So I would appreciate if any of you have any questions, but here's your opportunity to direct them at these young people. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment. Hats off to your teachers that reached out to you at those critical times. I hope you have an ability to go back and tell them how much that meant. And hats off to you for your leadership. I look forward to learning more about you. Thank you.
Senator Rieger.
Yes, Madam Chair, and thanks for saying that, Senator. What impressive presentations you made, and President Trendle, you didn't have notes, and you know, most people are very nervous just to be up there, and you were so at ease. But each of you are definitely future leaders. I just have a couple of questions. What are your career aspirations? I heard lawyer. for one, but if you would share that. And then also just in general, we're here looking at laws, testing expectations, et cetera. Just any comments you would have as to how we might get it better in terms of policy in St. Paul for what it really means on your educational journey in high school. So career aspiration and then any advice, because we all support your program.
My career aspirations, I would like to become a doctor, and family and consumer sciences education actually led me to that career. Through child development focus, I hope to become a neonatologist one day. As far as advice, one thing that I know FCCLA would really like to encourage is making a requirement to have family and consumer sciences as coursework before you graduate, because these classes are so important for everyday living, from learning how to sew, learning how to parent, things like that. They're so applicable in everyday life. So that would be my huge piece of advice. Just make it a requirement for students to be involved in family and consumer sciences classes before they graduate.
Anybody else want to speak to that?
Sure. Okay, I'll go next.
Skyler?
For my career aspirations, yes, I would like to be a lawyer. At the moment, I'm not sure what type, if I want to go into business law or criminal law or civil law. However, family and consumer sciences also has given me opportunities to explore various aspects of law, and I know that with family, I could go into various aspects of that between child care or divorce law or areas such as that. Like Morgan said, the family and consumer sciences classes are very influential and can help students to become better leaders, and any career and technical student organization and classes are very effective.
Great.
Yes. Madam Chair?
Liz?
In the future, I'd like to say that I belong to the Career of the Month Club, and it changes every day. But currently, I am enrolled at the University of Minnesota studying agricultural education with the intent to teach someday in a high school setting. If that weren't to go through, I could see myself working into agricultural business or maybe working with a youth organization such as the FFA in an advisory role somewhere at the national level. But as far as what we would like to see, I guess speaking to what Jason said earlier, agricultural education classes have many practical applications to life. Running a garage door opener, or last semester at college I learned how to weld. I mean, these kinds of things are basic skills, and besides that, we have many agri-science-based classes. From horticulture to animal science, they're classes that, in our opinion, could be core curriculum classes. If there's a way that we could see, animal science somehow taking the place of biology, or a horticulture class maybe substituting in for a biology, just because sometimes it's easier to learn with your hands, and sometimes it's easier when you can see the product of what you're working with. Like, if you have to learn the parts of a plant, why not grow one while you do it? So that's what I would like to see from you.
Okay. And Jason?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm currently studying at Bethel University in economics and environmental studies. It was probably one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make in my life of where to go to school, agricultural school or a small private Christian college. My hopes are, if I'm not burnt out from my first 4 years, to go get an ag econ degree at a university. So that's kind of what my ideal job is. That's a great question. I'm kind of along with Liz. I'm going to feel things out. I would love to stay in the industry of agriculture somehow, because one thing that's really opened my eyes this year is the network, the family, the people you get to work with are the people that I want to be around. So that's kind of what the future looks like. It's coming up fast, and I'm maybe a little scared at sometimes, but I just take a deep breath and know it'll be okay. For what we would like to see, just one thing, I completely agree with what Liz said. As we continue to progress through the years, one thing that we're noticing is that people are becoming farther and farther removed from their food source, from agriculture as a whole. This year, we started a new program called the Ag Literacy Challenge, trying to figure out how we can continue to share our stories, not only with people like you, but with elementary school students, with adults in our community. I came from a rural area, and there's some people who still don't necessarily understand the practices and what we do on a day-to-day basis. So one thing in the future, not exactly for certain how this would fit in with curriculum, but somehow continuing to figure out how we can spread the news and spread the message about agriculture in a positive light, because we are all sustained by it. So continuing to look at that aspect is the only maybe suggestions I have.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your presentation. And we've got another presentation coming up, so I don't know if you can continue to join us. I'm interested in hearing about somebody being from Tremont, Minnesota. And I had an aunt and uncle that lived there many years, so I've spent a fair amount of time in Tremont. So even before it was Tremont, it was Triumph and Monterey.
Madam Chair, I believe your aunt might have taught my dad second grade.
Florence Edmund, her name was.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, wow.
Very good. Well, thank you again. I'm not going to open up for more questions because I think we could probably carry on, and we do need to hear another speaker who's come from out of state to address us as well. But you've made your case well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to welcome Dr. James Stone, to our committee. From the Louisville National Research Center for Career and Technical Education. So I think, does that give you a little springboard to leap from here?
Close enough. Let me get started. First of all, thank you for the invitation, Senator Olson and your colleagues. I appreciate this opportunity. Just by way of a little background and a couple of disclaimers, I was on faculty at the University of Minnesota for 21 years, and prior to that, the University of Wisconsin at Madison for 3. So I stay tuned in to events in this part of the world, but also this morning I had a chance to have some of my former colleagues join me as we were talking with the House committee that's considering similar issues. So the other sort of disclaimer, I was intrigued. I'm married to a woman who has been a career and technical educator for quite a long time, and at one time she was a family and consumer science teacher, so I'm well acquainted with that field of endeavor. She also started a Skills USA chapter in a school in St. Paul, Minnesota that did not have one. So I'm intimately familiar with the value of and the potential for student organizations, and indeed that's part of my presentation. And at one level I could simply say amen and we'd be done and we could move on to the next thing, because they, in perhaps a more eloquent way, in a more personal way, made some of the points that I want to share with you today. So let me move as quickly as I can through my comments. And I always like to start with a philosophical perspective in any lecture that I may be giving. And I think, ironically enough, this illustrates a point that Jason made. For those of you who can't read the fine print, the vehicle being towed says, "My child is an honor student," and the vehicle towing the other vehicle says, "My child knows a cam from a rotor." And I think what it speaks to is one of the problems that I see and others see in education today, and that is we have separated out the practical education that some would argue really made us the nation we are, and have somehow put that over to the side and said we worship at the altar of pure academic education. And in that makes us very French. And that's a whole other conversation. So we'll go there. C'est la vie. But my point is simply, and again, Jason made it very well, is that part of education not only has to be about preparing young people to be successful as they continue learning throughout their lifetime, but also helping them understand the world around them in ways that makes them able to handle life as it comes at them. It's not without some irony that the National Research Center hosts at least one and sometimes two or three international groups a year who come to this country interested in two different kinds of things, and often both. One is, how is it that this education system generates so much creativity, despite all of our criticism? We are, after all, the leading nation of patents in the world and new inventions and new ideas. And the second thing they really puzzle over is how is it that we are such a practical people? And they come looking at our education system for those answers. So again, Jason, thank you for making that point for me. So what I'd like to do in a very brief period of time is talk about the issues of education reform, the role of career and technical education in this conversation. And in order to do that, especially because it's career and technical education, I think it's important that we take a look at the labor market to begin with. I then want to take a look at evidence about some of the things that we've been doing over the last 25 or 30 years under the rubric of education reform. One of the things, because of the nature of the work that I do and the world I live in, I'm always interested in sort of testing assumptions. Most of the assumptions that drive public policy are testable in the sense that there is evidence that might inform our decisions if we simply were to look at it. I don't want to change that. Go away. Thank you very much. little strange creatures going through my computer. So it's useful, I think, to look at the evidence, to look at the data. And in that, I'm going to start with a bit of an apology, and that is my presentation was described initially as sort of a fire hose of information. That is, there's a lot I'm going to share with you here in just a few moments. And I offer a bit of an apology for that. But in order to really adequately even just touch the surface on these questions, it's important to look at a variety of kinds of data. And indeed, I'll be pulling data from the work that we've done through the National Research Center over the last 10 years or so. I'll be pulling data from the National Center on Educational Statistics at the U.S. Department of Ed, data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Department of Labor, U.S., and two reports that I highly recommend as good nighttime reading. One is a report called Learning for Jobs. It's published, it's a study that was published by the OECD. The OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's an international organization of which the United States is a member. They took a very close look at 44 nations, including the United States, and tried to understand how they prepare young people to become successful, productive adults. And I'll be sharing some of those findings with you in this conversation. The second is a report that was just released a month ago, literally, by Harvard University, of all places, that is entitled Pathways to Prosperity. And they began by understanding that, by their definition and data, currently 42% of people who are 27 years old, 42% of that population, that cohort, has never set foot on a college campus. And what do we do in thinking about education reform with that recognition in mind, that despite the fact that our mindset is about sending every young person off to college, the truth of the matter is we have neither the capacity nor the ability to pay for it, nor necessarily will every kid make it there. So we have a variety of things that we need to look at in the context of this conversation. So if I can, let me jump into this really quickly. I'm going to give you the answers to the final exam before we start. And they are these. First of all, the labor market may not be what you think it is. And I'm going to pull again from national data. And by the way, that's another caveat. The perspective that I'm bringing to this conversation today is a national perspective. Every state has its own unique characteristics, but I would argue state boundaries in terms of labor markets are meaningless. Rather, there are regional labor markets, and indeed national, and I would argue global labor markets to which we need to attend as we think about the connection of education, learning, and future productive workforce. I also will argue that we have been at this game of adding more core academics to the regimen for every young person in school for almost 25 years, and the data that I will share with you will demonstrate that we've barely moved the needle, and in fact, the needle is going backwards on some key indicators. I will also argue, and provide some hopefully compelling evidence, that we must begin to think about more than one way of winning. We have devolved to a state where two conditions now seem to drive our thinking. One is that high school is the new middle school. That is, high school has no intrinsic value or power to help young people prepare to become adults other than what middle school does, which is to prepare them for the next level of education. And I would also argue that clearly is a pathway for some kids but there are other pathways and other ways of winning. And I co-opt that phrase from a colleague of mine who used to be at Penn State but has since retired and wrote a book by that title. So I'm pulling some of his ideas. And the final thing I'll argue is that a rigorous career and technical education program, which has three key components, which is an integrated curriculum, or as Liz talked about, or Morgan talked about, this notion of applied learning. It's another way to think about that. It has good work-based learning. You heard echoes of that here also by my younger colleagues, but also has student organizations involved in it. Three key pedagogic components to these programs. And I will show you data that suggests this is a very cost-effective way to begin to move the needle that we're all concerned about. So let me talk very briefly about the emerging workplace. I understand that there has been lots of conversation about STEM around probably in this room and elsewhere, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. STEM has become the new high tech. It's the new kind of sexy thing that everybody wants to talk about and have come to believe that that's what's really driving the workforce. But again, with these kinds of assumptions or beliefs, there are data that allow us to test these assumptions. So if you look at labor market data, what you find is that STEM occupations actually represent currently about 5% of the roughly 130 million people out there working today. Not an inconsequential number, but it is 5%. When we look at labor market projections down the road, what we find is that STEM is expected to grow to perhaps as much as 5.3% in the next decade or so. And by the way, you'll see the figure of the year 2018 frequently. That's the current range of projections that come out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They're about ready to update it. So STEM is important, but understand that it's important for a relatively small percentage of the workforce. In fact, if we look at current data, now the most current data that's available is from the year 2007. At that point, we were graduating over 400,000 individuals with bachelor's, master's, and PhDs in science and engineering kinds of programs. And at that point, we were annually adding about 150,000 jobs in those categories. That's not quite a 3-to-1 ratio of oversupply. So I think STEM is important, but it's important also to understand that the marketplace itself may be saturated. A more recent report from the National Research Council, and by the way, the National Research Council is an entity that was begun in the Lincoln administration when he pulled together the best thinkers around particular problems and issues of that day. And since that time, administration after administration has used the National Research Council to try to address important policy questions. It has a long history of pulling the best minds together around particular issues, questions, and concerns. From a recent report, one of the comments that was made was that in looking at the labor market, what they found was employers' greatest concern wasn't the numbers of, in this case, chemists or life science scientists, but rather whether they could work and work collaboratively. What they're touching into here is something that my colleagues addressed that we refer to as soft skills. Those generic, occupationally non-specific skills of being able to work with others in a workplace, work as part of a team, work collaboratively, lead in a team setting, and so on and so on. I have a list of some of those I'll share with you in a moment. So again, I think the emphasis on STEM is important, but we can't let that drive all of our thinking. Indeed, if we think about how the labor market is shaping, one of the ways that labor market economists talk about it is in terms of low skill, middle skill, and high skill occupations. I assume you've heard the phrase at some point, high skill, high wage. It's been part of the conversation around education that we have to really prepare our young people for high skill and high wage occupations. And that's certainly something to think about. But as you can see from this graphic, the largest anticipated growth over this next decade is in something called middle skill occupations. And I'll say more about those in a moment. The second largest growth area is in what are considered low skill. And the smallest area of growth anticipated, and this is aggregating data across all the occupational arenas, is in what we would consider high skill. Now, there's something else to understand about the current status of high-skill, high-wage occupations. You can add another high to that high-skill, high-wage, and that's highly exportable. there's been a growing phenomenon of exporting occupations like medical technology, medical research. There's a university I just read about last week that is exporting the grading of freshman composition papers to India. That one of the things that's interesting that's occurring is we have been exporting low-skill jobs for years. We've heard about that, and we're familiar with that phenomenon. What we are now seeing, though, is the exporting of high-skill jobs. And consider this scenario. If you are a Siemens Corporation, if you're IBM, if you're Honeywell, and you need an engineer, you can get a pretty competent engineer out of engineering schools in India for about $7,000 a year. The same position, the same kind of occupation in this country currently has a starting salary in the $50,000 to $70,000 range, depending on the specialization. So we are beginning to experience a drain at the high end that we've already been experiencing at the low end. So we need to keep this in mind as we think about what are the possible futures our young people might want to explore and where we might want to help them invest their energy, as my young colleagues talked about here. Middle skill occupations, I just want to say a word about them because they do represent probably a great secret. Secret in the sense that most high school counselors don't know much about them, most teachers don't know much about them, and most people who advise young people don't know much about them. But they're there. It's the largest area of growth. Over the last couple of weeks, I've had the opportunity to be in a lot of different states. But one of the things I've been doing is talking to people in manufacturing. General Electric, Boeing, Toyota, BMW, they wouldn't give me a sample. I was really frustrated with that. And other companies like that. And one of the things that they, among the things they talked about was a real concern about where their future workforce is coming from. And what they're looking for are people to work in manufacturing, which is by definition a middle skill occupation. To put a finer point on it, I was in Las Vegas actually doing real work. And there's a casino hotel operation that was planning to open. And they needed 6,000 front and back end people, as they call them, people to work out in the front of the hotel and the casino to service the customers, people to work the back, that's everything from housekeeping to the restaurants and all of that sort of thing. They needed 6,000 people. They had over 60,000 applicants. On the other hand, they needed 120 IT people, people that could set up and run the network systems and run the technology that was necessary to run the hotels. They needed 120. They had 60 applicants, 62, excuse me. One of the things that's really kind of interesting in today's economy is there's a dearth of skilled people, middle skill occupations, and there's an abundance of people that have generic skills that don't have a specific need in the labor market right now. Those middle skill occupations are vital. The other thing about them is the third bullet point I would just point out, and that is that in almost all cases, middle-skill occupations are occupations that defy exportation. You have to be there if you're a registered nurse to stick somebody with a needle. You can't export that. Here are just a few. There's a publication that I highly recommend to high school counselors. It's called 300 Best Jobs That Don't Require a Four-Year College Degree. And this just gives you a sense of what the median income is for these different kinds of occupations. So again, as we think about the labor market, a couple of key points. One is be careful of assumptions and sort of mythologies about what's going on out there. And the second is I think we need to pay very close attention to make sure that young people understand the possibilities that exist in some of these other occupational arenas. I'll slice this one more way. When we think about middle skill credentials, and these are typically licensures, credentials that may come from a 3-month, 6-month, 9-month, 18-month, or 2-year post-high school college experience, we find some interesting payoffs. We find that 43% of those with licensures and certificates earn more than those who have an associate's degree. We find that 27% of those with licensures and certificates earn more than those who have a baccalaureate degree. And we find that 31% of associate's degrees in general earn more than those who acquire a baccalaureate degree. I think it's very important for young people and their families to understand there are multiple pathways to becoming a successful adult. Not all of them run through a four-year college or university. Let me cut the data one more direction here. And labor market economists are peculiar people. They're peculiar in many ways, but not the least is they love to argue. And there are two competing sort of looks at the evolving labor market. One comes from the U.S. Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the other comes from the Center on Education and Work, which is at Georgetown University. Let me just kind of explain what this graphic represents, but then talk about the importance of it. The red columns represent the Center on Education for Work's analysis of the education demands for the emerging labor market. The red bar to the far left represents the occupations that require a baccalaureate or more to gain entry, and that's approximately 30-31% of the occupations evolving. So this is aggregating data across the entire labor market. They have a category called some college, which covers everything up to and including, but not including a baccalaureate. And by their numbers, it looks like about in the low upper 20% range of occupations will have this requirement for some college. And then high school or less is actually the largest clump of jobs, and that's about 34-35%. The Bureau of Labor Statistics slices the data differently. And without belaboring the point, the real interesting thing here to me is if you look at either the far left blue or the far left red bar, the estimates for occupations that require baccalaureate kinds of preparation range from about 22% to maybe 30-31% at the high end. There's a whole chunk in the middle that require some college, industry credentials, on-the-job training, employer-provided training. That's a huge chunk. But there's also still going to be a large portion of jobs that high school or less is sufficient preparation for. It's just the nature of the labor market. Now, despite this, we have organizations, public policy advocacy organizations like the American Diploma Project or Achieve Inc. and others, who have been making the case time and time again that whatever is necessary to be successful in a traditional four-year college pathway are the same academic skills necessary to be successful in the workplace. And I think they're wrong. That's a whole different conversation. But let's start with the assumption that they're right. And let's explore what this actually means. By the way, as a result of that, state after state across the country, under the banner of rigor, has been adding more and more academic coursework to requirements for graduation. Math course credit requirements have gone from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3. Most states now have bumped it up to 4. Science has gone the same direction, and so forth. And this idea of rigor meaning more, I had a young person tell me that if you say those two words together and add a third syllable, you kind of get a sense of the measure of the effect on young people sitting in those classrooms hour after hour. So this is one, by the way, where we can actually test the assumption with data. If we assume that having kids take more academics, presumably taught in traditional ways, not in the ways that were described by some of our young colleagues here, we can test that question of whether adding more actually moves the bar, moves the needle. Does it improve achievement? And we have, fortunately, something we can look at that goes back more than 30 years, and that is something called the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. If we look at reading, I'll share with you reading, mathematics, and science. If we look at reading, what we find is in the early 1980s, the average high school graduate completed about 13 core academic credits. Now it's up, actually, the most current figure is like 20.1 or something like that. So these are 2004 data. One of the things that's happened with the NAEP is they've changed the test, they've changed the metric, and you can't continue the trend line. You have to start all over again. But if we look at that time period where we've seen this growth of academic core credits being required, what we find is a statistically significant decline in the reading skills of kids. In fact, as late as 2009, the estimate was that only about a third of young people exiting high school were proficient in reading. If we look at science, we find a similar pattern in the period between early 1970 and the late 1990s. We had doubled the amount of science credits that kids were taking, and science scores on the NAEP had gone down a statistically significant amount. The line across the bottom represents the new test, and in the very short period of time when they began that one, and in less than 10 years, there was a statistically significant decline in kids' ability to master science, yet they're taking more science courses. If we look at mathematics, we find something interesting. There was a significant jump between the mid-1980s and the early 1990s. But that was before we started adding more credits for math for graduation. As we began to add more credits for graduation, what we find is that the line is essentially level. It's bobbed up and down a little bit, but it hasn't really changed significantly. So if we think that simply adding more credits to everyone's requirements is somehow going to help them better master science, math, and develop better reading and writing skills, the evidence doesn't support that. The ACT actually has some interesting analyses that they've done. And they've looked at kids, and by the way, ACT, now you have to think about this, with the exception, I think, of two states, ACT is an optional test. It's a test taken by young people. Some take the SAT, others take the ACT, who think that they're going to a college that has requirements. You've got to get a cut score of 22 or 24 and so on. So if you will, they're kind of the best and the brightest. And yet what ACT has found is that kids who take their test, best and the brightest, it's the population, who got a B or better in Algebra 2, considered the new gateway course, 43% of them were unable to get at least a C in their first college math course. So there is a huge disconnect. I would argue that part of the problem is that it isn't that the math doesn't link to what they see next. It's that you get these kids, and I've seen them up close and personal because I have five now kids who are now beyond the age of 20, so they've been through this. They get the C minus, the C plus, they go on to the next course. And they struggle through that, they go on to the next course. There's no sense, no effort of mastery of any of this content. And yet, if they're going to be successful as adults, they're going to need mastery of a lot of this stuff that they're experiencing as part of the high school curriculum. And I'll come back to that notion of mastery in just a bit. So again, more math, more science, more of everything, we really aren't seeing much change. Where we are seeing change is in the percentage of young people who are voluntarily choosing to opt out of school. Current estimates, and these are estimates because it's very difficult to pin down exact numbers, of young people who drop out of high school suggest that currently somewhere between 68 and 70% of those who start ninth grade actually finish high school in 4 years. This is the first generation of kids for whom graduation is less likely to occur than the preceding generation. That has never occurred before in our history. And we trail virtually every other industrialized nation in terms of the number of young people, the percentage of young people who successfully finish what we would consider high school. This, I would argue, is the necessary and first condition to which we must pay attention as we think about how do we make education work better for more young people. Now, Bob Lehrman, who's another labor market economist, has argued that we've really got the lens turned completely the wrong way. We make assumptions about what the labor market needs and drive on that, more math, more science, and so forth, when in fact employers have other needs that are largely unaddressed. I'll make one other rhetorical point and then I'll get off the rant. I've often wondered about this, but if an educated workforce is so critical to attracting high-tech manufacturing to different communities, then how do you explain why Toyota, BMW, General Electric, Boeing, and a whole long list of others choose to locate in communities in states that arguably have rather poor education systems? That's a semi-rhetorical question. I have an answer which makes it not rhetorical. My point is simply this, that an educated workforce is important, but that's not what drives business and industry decisions. But educating young people has intrinsic importance aside from just that. So let's talk about academic skills in the workplace. Let's assume for the moment that this idea that the academic skills for college are the same as for the workplace. And let's pretend that that's actually accurate. ACT has done a really interesting kind of analysis that I find quite intriguing. I'm going to share just a little snippet of it with you here. What we find is they have something they call a work readiness assessment that they've linked back to ACT test scores. And for the purpose of this conversation, what they've done is they've looked at what they call Zone 3 jobs. Now, Zone 3 jobs are jobs that pay what we might consider to be a living wage, have benefits. They're largely middle skill in nature. And let's take a look for just a moment, pardon me, at what they consider to be the math skills necessary for that kind of occupation. Pardon me. If you look at the column on the right-hand side, this is their applied math skill list, which links back to ACT scores in the 20 to 23 range on the math assessment in ACT. And what I find intriguing about this list is as you look at it and you see things like calculate using mixed units, decide what information calculations or conversions need to be used to solve a problem, calculate using several steps of logic. These are not algebra level skills. These are skills that are learned in elementary school and in middle school, largely. And in fact, if you look at other labor market data, let me skip to it real quickly. What we find is that while most people use math in the labor market, a recent study that was published just a couple of years ago shows that most people need basic numeracy skills, addition, subtraction, multiplication, divisions, fractions, percentages, decimals, facilitation with those, and by the way, estimation and measurement. These are critical skills, and the irony is that when you test young people who finished high school, no matter how much math they've taken, guess what? They can't deal with fractions, decimals, percentages, estimation, measurement. So we've got the lens turned the wrong way, and we're missing the boat big time. But let me go back to this real quick example. Here's something called electronic tech. This is a job. This particular advertisement was advertising it at $35,000 to $45,000 a year, depending on experience. Clearly a middle-skill occupation, good salaries, et cetera, et cetera. These are the requirements. And if you actually kind of look at what those requirements represent, you have about four of them that are technical skills, knowledge of operating systems, fundamental knowledge of networking, Microsoft applications, troubleshooting skills. Then you've got about three sets of what we call soft skills. It's the kinds of skills that were being addressed by my colleagues here earlier. Their ability to work with others in a team kind of structure and situation. They're motivated, they're energetic, they have good communication skills, a good work ethic, strong organizational skills. Where in our current curriculum are young people given the opportunity to learn this? I would argue my colleagues described it quite eloquently. You're not going to learn these things in a math class, in a science class, possibly in an English class if they do it right. But these are the kinds of things in demand. The other set of requirements here, as you can see, are a lot of experience. And you get that from actually being in the workplace. And I'm going to come back to this issue in just a couple of minutes. And by the way, most of these ads for these kinds of occupations call for an associate's degree level background, an AAS, if you're familiar with that concept, very strong in technology and so forth. But they pay very well. Now, when you talk to employers, and when I was talking to these manufacturers in these different states, a lot of what they talked about was this list of what are often called employability skills or soft skills. And it's a list you're probably familiar with. The interesting thing and perhaps the most ironic thing about these conversations, without exception, whether I was talking to the person from Boeing or the person from Toyota or any of these other places, the first thing they talked about were these employability skills. They didn't talk about technical skills. They didn't talk about math skills. They eventually would. But the highest thing on their list is they wanted people that had some could demonstrate to them that they would be able to work in a workplace. And the other things came after that. Now, technical skills. The report that I alluded to earlier, Learning for Jobs, published by the OECD, among their conclusions is that the states that have the most success in transitioning young people from whatever their public education system is into successful adulthood provided them immediate job skills, not deferred job skills expected to gain later, but immediate job skills along with industry certifications that were evidence of those job skills, in addition to the kinds of numeracy and literacy skills necessary for them to continue their education. Not either or, but clearly both. We've begun to look at this, and we have identified so far with data from just four states, there are at least 132 industry-recognized credentials that could be available through existing career and technical education programs. And emphasize could be, because the programs exist, the content aligns with the industry credentials, but they don't necessarily have the kids actually sit and take the tests. But they could. Now, let me walk you through a scenario, what I call the college and career dilemma. Is that the college and career language something that's been part of your conversations? Nod the head, yes. Make the prof feel good, shake the head, say okay. All right. I was told earlier that I threw out too many acronyms and so on, so I want to try to make sure I've still got the class with me. Let's start with 100 kids who start ninth grade. As we said earlier, current estimates are maybe 70% of them actually finish high school on time. This means we now have 30 kids out of that original 100 who are moving off into the workplace with not much to show the employer and say, please hire me. Of those 70 who finished, current estimates suggest that about 62% of them will start college 2 or 4 years within the first 2 years of leaving high school. This means that we have another 25% now that have moved into the workplace with a high school credential and saying, please hire me. 43 start college, almost half of them drop out within the first year. And now we have another 19% of that original cohort that's moving into the workplace with a few college credits maybe and probably a lot of debt. We have a system that works reasonably well for that roughly 25% of the kids who start ninth grade in our country. As a system, I think we really need to step back and think about what this means. And we've been at this notion of making college for all a reality for 25 years. And I think it's time to seriously consider other options if we really want to get serious about making the future of our young people a little brighter. So let's talk about a role for career and technical education. The Pathways to Prosperity, the Harvard report that I alluded to, which you can pull down online as a PDF, it's a freebie. Among their conclusions, and they have quite a few, or points that they make, is that in countries outside of the United States, by the way, the term that's used is VET, vocational education and training. Everywhere in the world, they recognize that phrase. So we use career and technical education, but assume for the moment they're pretty much the same idea. One of the things that they point out is that these VET programs are not programs designed for kids that they think can't make it in life. Rather, these are programs that are the first choice for a lot of young people and their families. And they are high-quality programs. And they're actually designed on the premise, just as my young colleagues were saying, is that an awful lot of people like to learn in ways other than sitting in a classroom and taking notes and taking tests, which is to say in an applied, contextual approach. And that's what these programs provide. Here's the kicker, though, to me, is that young people who finish these VET programs in countries outside, overseas, and by the way, these are 44 nations in all parts of the world, they come out of those programs with the same level of skill and knowledge as people who graduate from our two-year technical colleges come out with. Now, think about that for a moment. What is there about our adolescents that suggests they're not capable of doing this? And I would suggest nothing other than inertia and how we are wedded to an existing way of thinking about how education must be. In every other industrialized country in the world, substantial percentages, and sometimes as much as 80% of the young people, move through intensive, employer-driven, work-based learning that leads to immediate employability and good jobs, as we would like to think about them. In fact, if you look at some of the countries in the report, the low end of kids who engage in this kind of learning is 5% in Ireland to more than 80% in the Czech Republic. And you can see these other countries, Japan, United Kingdom, France of all places has been increasing the number of apprenticeships over the last couple of decades. And they're sort of the epitome of everybody going to the university because that's how you get the good government job, which gets you 6 months off on vacation and two bottles of wine. The U.S. has such a small I hope that's not in the record. There is such a small percentage of kids in this country who have that kind of experience that we don't even show up on the graph. So what can we say about what we know about career and technical education? First of all, one of the challenges I know you all are facing, because we face it in my new home state of Kentucky, and it's the problem in every state in the country, and that is we have very scarce resources, and how do we invest them? Whether we're talking education or other areas of public policy. One of the ways to think about how we make these decisions is to look at a notion called return on investment. Businesses do it every day. There are 3 or 4 states that have actually done return on investment kinds of analyses. The state of Tennessee just recently completed an analysis where they recognized that their state investment in career and tech ed returned nearly $2 for every dollar invested. Oklahoma, I think their numbers are a little weird, but they come back with a 12-to-1 ratio and a total dollar amount of a $2 billion return for their state investment in career and technical education. The state of Washington, and I don't have the slide handy, has done 2 iterations of this study. They do it about every 5 or 6 years under state law. And the 2 iterations that they've done, in both cases, you find parallel and similar results. And that is that for high school level career and tech ed, the state completely captures its investment in 2.5 years, completely captures its investment in 2.5 years, and then beyond that point, it begins to grow in terms of its return on investment. Post-secondary is actually a shorter return on investment in the state of Washington. That's perhaps one of the most rigorous studies of this kind. So it seems to me quite clear that the kinds of investments that you would make in career and technical education in this state are things about which you could be very comfortable. At a personal level, other kinds of analyses. There was a recent study that's gotten a lot of attention. Actually, it's been an ongoing study of career academies. And what we find is there's been about an 11% earnings return for young people who go through a career academy kind of experience in high school. Higher for males and for females, and that's got something to do with the quirks of the labor market. But nonetheless, there is that return. So again, at a personal level, at a state level, we're finding that it's a good investment. Let me suggest that there are three challenges that we need to really think about. The first is, as we think about how do we make high school, how do we make school work better for more kids? The first is what I would call engagement. And there are multiple measures of that. The one that we've paid the most attention to is whether or not kids finish high school. That's the necessary first condition to anything else. If we can't get them through high school, the rest of the conversations are sort of moot. The second is achievement, and the third is transition. So how do we move high school from becoming the new middle school to actually making high school matter? So let's look at this question of engagement. And I'll apologize in advance, but I love this graph because it's so cool. Now, for those who don't like graphs, let me try to explain this one to you. We looked at a set of national data, and we asked the question, what's the relationship between participation in career and tech ed of any kind, family and consumer science, carpentry, IT, cosmetology, doesn't matter, any kind of career and tech ed, and these are national data, what's the relationship between how much of that they take and how much core academics they take? So I've got three lines here. The top line in red, I think you can see that, are low-achieving students based on test scores. This is test score-based only. The green line are average-ability kids, and the blue line are the academic Wunderkinder. Those are the kids that score pretty well on tests. And so the question is, as we move from left to right, from having a zero ratio, in other words, no career in tech ed, to more and more career in tech ed, what happens to these dropout lines? And what you find is for these kids who are considered low ability based on test scores, and I emphasize that, they move from approximately a 45% likelihood or probability of dropping out of high school down to about a 12% probability of dropping out of high school when you move from having no career tech ed to a roughly 1-to-2 ratio, one career tech ed course for every two academics. Now, you'll notice the green and blue lines drop a bit. The curves flatten out more quickly. But the point is that those lines are significant. That means there are a lot of high-ability kids who do drop out of high school. You may not be aware of that, but it's true. Career and tech ed has the power to help young people see value in education and get them engaged. That transcends academic ability. But it's particularly powerful for those young kids who are least likely to really get turned on by taking Algebra 27. We did another study, a different kind of study. We looked at schools in three high-poverty communities that were trying to use career and tech to help deal with issues they were addressing. And on the dropout question alone, or the graduation question, these are two large urban communities, one rural community, high poverty, high second language learner population. What we found was in all three, the number of CTE courses one takes is predictive of whether or not they'll finish high school. So again, and in fact, I just got a table sent to me. We're looking at some more contemporary data, and we're finding somewhat parallel findings. And so as you begin to see the same story over and over again in the data, pretty soon you begin to go, oh, something's going on there. And something is going on. And it points to the power and the value of career and technical education as part of the high school experience. So let me suggest that I'm going to skip through this really quickly because I'm watching the time here. There are three pedagogic opportunities that we should think about in career and technical education. The first, of course, is what goes on in the classroom. And I think my young colleagues talked about the notion of applied learning, was referred to hands-on learning. Learning in that way is particularly powerful. We call it contextual learning, but it has a similar kind of notion. And then project-based learning. These are two strategies that are used frequently in career and technical education, and we've actually done some research on these I'll share with you. Work-based learning takes many forms. One of the things I can tell you about work-based learning is that fewer and fewer young people are given the opportunity to participate in it. part of the reason is that we keep expanding the requirements in the school day and in the school year. And the school day and the school year is a zero-sum game. There are only 6.5 or whatever the hours are in a school day. We don't vary that much, whether you slice it into 7 class periods or 5 or 4 or whatever. And for some reason, we just can't get beyond the idea that by the early part of June, we have to leave the school building. So the school year is also a zero-sum game. There's a limited amount of curriculum space to do things. And as you fill up that curriculum space with requirements, you are effectively pushing out opportunities for young people to participate in the kinds of things that my young colleagues talked about and the kinds of things that really could matter in making life better for a lot more young people. Real quickly, the first thing that we looked at was a study on mathematics. Could we teach mathematics in the context of agriculture, health occupations, business and marketing? IT was another one of the areas, and auto technology. And here's what we found, just very quickly. We used 3 standardized off-the-shelf tests, something called Terra Nova, which is used by 30 states as their high school exit exam, AccuPlacer, which is a college placement test, and then WorkKeys, which is a kind of an applied test. And what we found is that if in the experimental classroom, and by the way, we had about 3,000 students, 200 teachers in 9 states involved in this research. It's experimental design, very rigorous, as they like to say, inside my world. What we found is that on 2 of the 3 tests, the kids in the experimental classes scored significantly better than kids in the control classes. And they scored better on the college placement test, and they scored better on the traditional measures of math. That's what the Terra Nova represents. Now, just to bore you with a little more data junk, one of the ways to sort of ask and answer the question of how much of an effect one has is imagine for a moment we take a kid who got this experimental treatment and plunk him or her into the control class who didn't get the treatment. Where would they show up on the normal test distribution curve? And in essence, we had the effect of moving kids from the 50th to the 71st percentile in Terra Nova and to the 67th percentile in the AccuPlacer, the college placement test. Now, for those of you who don't spend your time looking at this kind of stuff, I can assure you that these results are astounding. You don't find these kinds of effect sizes in any kind of research in education. In fact, we were challenged by the Institute on Educational Sciences, which is the U.S. Department of Ed's research wing. And so we sent them our data because they didn't believe it, and they analyzed the data, and they wrote a note back saying, well, okay, you win. And as a result, we've been working with states to help them think about how they do this. So we found a lot of things. The most important thing from this list is that third bullet. We were able to do this without losing any of the power of the occupational technical stuff. That is, on the occupational technical test, those were no different, but we increased the math skills. So it was kind of a wonderful win. The other thing about this study that I would just point out is that one of the challenges in thinking about bringing interventions in to try to make school better for kids is oftentimes you bring an outside entity in, they do lots of things, scores get better, whatever it is you're trying to measure gets better, and then that outside entity goes away, and guess what? Teachers go back to doing what they were doing before. So one of the real issues in education reform is whether or not it has any sustaining power. So we went back a year later, and what we found was about 75% of the experimental teachers who got the full dosage, if you will, were still using the stuff, continuing to develop lessons and so forth. That's terrific. About 20-some percent of the control teachers were using it. Now, what we did with control teachers who had to behave themselves during the study, not do anything different, after the study, we brought them in. We did a, you know, kind of traditional professional development, gave them the materials. But that's not bad. But the real surprise in this is that bar on the left-hand side, and it's labeled total surprise for a reason. And that is, when we went back, and this wasn't part of the study, we found that 60% of the math teachers who were helpers in this project, they didn't teach the stuff in these CTE classes, but they helped us design the lesson plans and coached us on how to do it. 60% of them were using these vocational lessons in their math classes because they recognized this was a better way to teach those underlying math concepts. That was indeed a total surprise. We've since gone on to look at a study in literacy, and I won't bore you with the details. The short version is we tested 2 approaches to literacy, and both of them worked in terms of our experimental research design. The kids in the experimental classes who were exposed to these literacy interventions scored significantly better than kids in the control classes who had the regular curriculum. We are now moving on to science integration, and in fact, Jim Lysing at the University of Minnesota is one of our partners in this study, and that's underway as we speak, and we're working primarily in agriculture and health sciences in that area. So let me talk just briefly about career student organizations, but my colleagues here actually said it better than I can. But we've actually begun to collect data and do some research on this, and here's the short version, and they spoke to it. When comparing kids who are in CTE programs with career tech student organization experience to those who are in CTE programs where they don't have that opportunity, we found that those kids in the career tech student organizations actually outperformed the comparison kids on a number of measures: academic engagement, grades, career self-efficacy, college aspirations, and employment prospects. We have some measures for all of those things. So again, aside from the value and power of career tech student organizations that they talked about, we actually have, and we have some other research that we're doing now on this, we actually have data that supports their points of view. They gave you their personal stories. I can tell you from a national point of view, the data supports what they're telling you. I think it's something we really need to pay attention to. Very briefly, work-based learning. We know from a lot of research that it does reduce the likelihood of dropping out of school and improves academic achievement, which is something that seems counterintuitive, but it's true. Let me just skip to, again, a graphic that comes from some international research. The vertical axis on this is the completion ratio goes from 60 to 95%. And the line across the bottom going from left to right indicates the percentage of young people who are in these intensive work-based learning kinds of VET programs. And what you find, those nations clustered at the top right-hand side, where you have a high percentage of young people in these kinds of intensive work-based learning experiences, are much more likely to graduate from high school. The United States, Canada, and Spain are clumped down here on the lower left. Less intensive, much less likely to graduate from high school. Again, I think as we consider what's necessary for a quality career and technical education program, student organizations, a contextually based curriculum in the classroom, and work-based learning are the components, all of which have research supporting their use. The final point I'd make on this about we have to be careful not to turn high school into the new middle school is it's important to understand that high school is the last publicly funded opportunity we have to prepare young people to become successful adults. Again, depending on whose numbers you buy into, somewhere between 40 and perhaps as much as 50%, or as many as 50% of young people who start ninth grade will never wind up in college for a host of reasons, not the least of which is cost and capacity. Once you leave high school, somebody starts picking up the bill. The average community college tuition bill is around $2,000 to $3,000 a year. It's a bargain compared to the average four-year college bill. I have still two kids in college, one of whom is here at the University of Minnesota. The other is preparing to become an agricultural teacher at UW River Falls, despite everything his mom and I told him about don't become a teacher. Where did we go wrong? The fact of the matter is it's a very expensive proposition. The other problem we find is increasingly across the country there is headline after headline after headline, and data supported by the American Association for Community Colleges, is that community colleges are at and beyond capacity. Programs are literally shutting their doors. So if we assume that occupational development somehow is magically going to happen after high school, we are effectively condemning a substantial percentage of young people to failure. And I don't think we can do that. I don't think we should do that. So as we think about all of the considerations that come before your committee, I do believe it's important to keep these caveats in mind. This OECD publication has a number of key points. Again, I encourage you to take a look at it. But their research shows that strong vocational education and training programs or strong CTE programs increase competitiveness, that they do compare, can and do prepare students for further study and jobs. But a critical component, and this is a whole other conversation, is career guidance. We have precious little to none available to most students in most schools today. And even though high school counselors do heroic jobs, when you have an average high school to counselor to student ratio of anywhere from 4 to 600, depending on the state you're in, depending on the school district, it is impossible to do the things they must do that are routine in nature and also provide substantial and substantive career development experiences for young people. So that's another challenge that we face. So this is where I started. So here are the answers to your final exam. Again, I would suggest that if the labor market is driving part of your thinking, it's important to be clear about what the labor market's actually going to look like. Don't rely on assumptions or sort of wonderful stories that some people might tell you. Look at the data. That's what I would urge you to do. I would also argue again that 25 years or more of just simply stacking on more academic courses, presumably taught in the traditional way, is not moving the needle anywhere in terms of learning. And I would argue the other thing here to think about is the notion of mastery, that we need young people to have mastery of academic content that can be used to solve problems, whether it's in the workplace or in the home environment or indeed in the college setting. And that if we really want to help more young people succeed, we have to recognize there are indeed other ways of winning than the traditional four-year college track. And then finally, a rigorous career and technical education program requires really three components. The career and tech student organizations that are derivative of a very high quality, and dare I use the word, rigorous career tech curriculum, where young people have the opportunity to test out their skills in a work-based learning environment. So I'm going to stop. If you would like more information, that's our website where a lot of this information is available, and also that's my email, and I'm always happy to continue the conversation.
This is a lot of information, but good stuff that I think we need to consider, and I appreciate your presentation. Are there any questions that are burning in you to ask? Senator Wieger.
Well, Madam Chair, yes, it is burning, because you know, we're making some very significant assumptions that our expectations are for STEM are to align with the job market, and if there's evidence that it's misaligned, we need to get it right. And it, not only is it ultimately so misleading to graduates, but also to employers. And so I sure would like at some point to get a rebuttal, perhaps from the business community, which has stood pretty strong on STEM, from the department as well. You've indicated there is potential unrealistic expectations on curriculum. And to that extent, as we look at high-stakes testing, as we look at standards in biology, chemistry, et cetera, we had testimony that maybe we should have some flexibility in science that relates to the job she's going to prepare for. And we put so much money into the higher ed, where if we should look at redirecting that in programs right now that you're suggesting, I certainly would be for it.
And Senator Wieger, I think one of the things that we shouldn't miss was, I don't think this is an anti-STEM. It's identifying the fact that young people learn in different ways and that they, in fact, can build strength in the science and math if they are taught and have an opportunity to learn it in an applied way, such as our career and technical programs, and that we are missing the boat for a lot of young people who aren't as attuned to the straight academic programs that as others might be. If we focus it in one direction and not have a balanced approach, we are missing the boat for young people, and that gives them, it doesn't rule out that they might not pursue higher academic, higher levels of academic preparation in post-secondary education. Okay. But having that doesn't prevent that, but many of them will find other kinds of options along the way that are equally fulfilling for them. So I think it's kind of making a case for the fact that we've the pendulum has swung, but we're really having a hard time keeping any of the because of the way we schedule and the graduation loads of having some of these options available at our high school level. And that's, I think, what the challenge is. It isn't, I don't think it's belittling the STEM notion, but rather saying we are missing an opportunity because the results, and you know we're dealing with it, the dropout, the graduation rate is declining. We aren't getting the achievement levels that we want. in spite of some of the things that we've been doing. He's not saying anything that we haven't been facing, but he said it in a somewhat different way.
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't see it as an indictment of STEM, but I saw a call for flexibility and a realistic alignment with jobs that are there and the expectations that we are mandating. But I appreciate that we had you schedule all this today.
Thank you.
Can I make one observation, just a recommendation indeed? And I think you captured what I was trying to emphasize. I do think that we've sort of oversold STEM as sort of the occupational direction that everybody's going to. There's opportunity there, to be sure. And those STEM-like skills are applicable in a lot of non-STEM occupations. So I think you captured most of what I was trying to suggest. But I do think we want to be a little careful about assuming that everybody needs 4 years of mathematics. Most liberal arts majors in colleges require one math course. And, you know, if you're moving into a math-intensive college major, yeah, you probably need 3 or 4 years of math, but the percentage of young people who actually are moving that direction is only part of all of the young people who start higher ed. The other point, though, I think two observations. One is I think it is useful to try to get more data. You have a gentleman here, and I believe Tom Stimson, is he, you all know him?
He's our state economist.
He's a terrific researcher, and I think he can give you a very objective picture of what's going on in Minnesota. Having said that, let me suggest that kids in school today are not Minnesota citizens, they're world citizens. So in addition to thinking about what Minnesota proper has going for it, it's important to also understand those larger opportunities into which where our kids, I mean my kids and my grandkids, are competing against kids in other countries even. And so it's a bigger picture grounded and nested in what's happening here in Minnesota. The last point I'd make real quickly is another reading assignment. You mentioned standards and testing. Some of you may know the name Diane Ravitch, but in the early days of No Child Left Behind, she was sort of the intellectual godmother of that movement. And ironically enough, she came out of sort of the liberal side of politics, but was a strong advocate for No Child Left Behind. She recently published a book. I believe the title is something like The Death and Life of the Great American School System, in which she completely savages the effects of No Child Left Behind and essentially says, I was wrong. We really screwed it. And she just takes it apart piece by piece. And I think it's a useful read because we have sort of gotten on this notion that somehow setting standards is the solution. And standards are fine. But if we don't actually align the teaching to the curriculum, and as you were suggesting, we provide those opportunities for young people who learn in different ways to master those standards. But again, the link of standards to something, she talks a lot about that. So I suggest that as further kind of background for your thinking.
Anybody else have a question or a challenge or thought? All right. Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you, young people. You laid the groundwork very nicely for his presentation. Senator Stumpf has a bill that he's not here, unfortunately, because he and I are fairly strong allies in our concern that we not let this totally slip away from us. So we will be considering that later. I want to also make an announcement that we have reserved 112 on Thursday for a hearing if Wednesday's agenda is not completed in a timely manner. So we have a number of bills tomorrow. So hopefully if you would make every effort to be on time so that we can complete, we will not have to have a Thursday meeting. So all business having been completed, I will declare the meeting adjourned.
Good drive down there.
Yeah, thank you.